Welcome, welcome, and welcome to another Wobba Pod podcast. I'm Rod Smith from Awobbical. Well, over the months, we've had some real talent, exotic, interesting people appear on this show, and today is no exception. Our special guest today has done so many things that makes me think she's our black superwoman. She's written her autobiography. She's worked the education system, the health system, the soul system, Awobbical Voices. There's a blast from the past. Family, kids, community, to unity, diversity. Get it? University, like to caring and sharing, a laugh that makes you smile. This amazing woman has had hurdles that a lot of us only hear or read about in books. She's the dynamic, the dashing, the devoting, the delicious and desirable. Ooh, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, she's the one and only Donna, the divine Meehan. You like that introduction?
Thank you for that introduction, Rod. I've never had one like that, but thanks so much. It's lovely to be here and thank you for inviting me to come and share.
The honour is all mine. You know, there was another word, a D word I found. It was called DAPA. And I Googled what it meant. It meant neat and trim and dress and appearance. But when I was adding it in there, I was like, the divine, the dazzling, the DAPA. And I was just thinking, no, it just doesn't work. The DAPA. So, Donna, as I said, welcome. We've known each other for a long, long time. You've known me since I was a teenager.
Yes.
And that would go back to our Awobbical days.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wasn't working for Awobbical then, but you was.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Started Awobbical in 88. So resource officer, was promoted a month later to community development officer, and loved my time at Awobbical. It was that opportunity to engage with our elders and our youth. On the first day, Jimmy Wright gave me the radio program and, you know, that just opened so many doors to the community, because until then I'd been a stay-at-home mum with my three children, my hubby, and then, you know, going to uni. And this was my first job. And, you know, even though I'd found my Aboriginal family, this was the first time I connected with Aboriginal people in Newcastle. I didn't know there was any.
It's funny when you said resource room. It actually took me straight back, because our Wickham building, which a few of these guys have been to, the upstairs one. I actually still remember your resource room.
Yeah.
Or the resource room upstairs there. It was pretty big.
It was. We actually started, I started at the Awobbical Lands Council, and it was the old police station, and my room was the exercise courtyard, and Trevor Patton was in one of the cells, and we had storage in the other cell. Then we went to Hannell Street, and right up in the tower, I was developing our radio program, which was damaged in the earthquake.
Yes, yes. When I first started working for Awobbical way back then, one of those cell rooms was also my office. The big heavy metal doors were still on there. Jeez, they were heavy, weren't they?
They were.
Donna, today we're talking about it's Reconciliation Week, and I thought, you know, if there's anyone that's been through things in life and hurdles that could talk about, or maybe, you know, be for it or against it, I thought it'd be you with your life. If you can you give us a run through from, like, you know, maybe starting from, you know, where you were born and where you're from, your brothers and sisters, and to where you are now?
Yes. So I'm a Gamilaroi woman. I was born in Canamble. And when I did meet my family eventually, the first thing my brother and my mother said, we're Gamilaroi. And so that's why I keep to that, because that's what my mother told me. Grandfather was from Pilliga Scrub. And so
where's that?
The back of Narrabri we wore.
Okay.
Pilliga, yeah. And so his name was James Boney, and then he changed it to Jimmy Welsh. And so that's our family, the Welsh family. So I was born in Canamble, lived there, happy child for the first 5 years, and then mum got a letter from the government saying, have all your children at the train station the following Tuesday. So it would have been the 21st of April, 1960. And so all my siblings were on that train. My brother Barry was 9, Witty was 7, I was 5 and a half. My brother Kevin was 4, Robbie was 2, and Jane and Wayne, the twins, were 6 weeks old. And I can still remember standing on that platform waiting for the train to come in. We were excited because we thought we were going for joyride. We did not know what was happening. So being brought to Newcastle, I was fostered and adopted by loving European parents. I'm married, I was educated here and have worked as a liaison, Aboriginal liaison officer with the Wabigal community for over 32 years now.
So you went to university. Why did you go to university?
Well,
Wallatooka.
My Aboriginal mum was supposed to come to Newcastle to start the first chapter of my book, and she died of a heart attack 2 days before she was supposed to leave. So about 3 months into Sorry Business, and I heard Mick Davidson on the television behind me saying, "Oh, your Currys and Murrays, come to university. I'll be here." He was the first Aboriginal person in Newcastle to graduate in social welfare. John Heath had graduated in education, but Mick, first in social welfare, come over, have a yarn to us. If I can do it, you can do it. And I'm saying, yeah, sure. Then again behind me, he said, "I know what you just said. You said, yeah, sure." He said, "Come and have a yarn to me."
That sounds just like him.
I went. And was wonderful. And I did social welfare, but I did every assignment on an Indigenous perspective because that's how I wanted to learn my culture, my history, our customs.
So from there you went on to Wabigal?
Went to work at a Wabigal. Was there 7 years.
Yeah.
And then Big
and
Fish.
As you said, it was a part of cultural resource. What was your first job?
So, first of all, I was the resource officer.
Yep.
With the library and, administration. And then a month later, Jimmy promoted me to community development officer because I had an advanced diploma in social welfare. And it was just fun. I felt guilty each week taking home my pay packet because I felt I'm getting paid to learn all this. Yeah.
Wabigal Voices, how was that?
Oh.
Who'd you take it over from?
I think there was Tony Schofield.
That's
and
right,
Dallas,
yes.
Dallas Faulkner. And the community said, "It's great to have a Koori radio program," because I was sharing information, And you're well aware there's a large non-Aboriginal audience, so I was educating them. But, the community would say, "Oh, the boys only ever talked about football. It's nice to have a proper radio program." And I only knew one black song. Only knew Royal Telephone. I thought, how many times can I play it? So learning what our people were singing about was amazing. It was like an open door to the community. And because it takes 3 years to get accepted. Nobody knew me because I'd been a stay-at-home mum. But, that opened the door and community could hear my passion, my love for my people, my history. I'd never say anything negative on radio, because I didn't want white fellas to have anything to talk about us. Mm. So it was always positive, promoting our achievements, and they are numerous, and it was just fun.
You would probably still be known mostly for Wabigal, the main person. As you said, there were a couple of people before you, but I think you were probably the longest running and and probably most successful.
7 years. Well,
and then that's when I started
much.
Work, and then Jimmy threw it to me. Me, Berkey, and Debbie sworn at it for about 2-3 years.
Yeah,
but that was fun. So what did you do after that?
Then I was the little fish that jumped in the big pond. I went into education.
Yep.
Took over Claire Sager's position, Aboriginal Community Liaison Officer. And Merv and I were the only two black fellas in head office. And my orientation was, this is your desk, here's your phone, go to it. Little did I know I'd be dealing with conflict, teachers, students, parents. But, each job, you just give it your best shot and you learn as you go along.
And from there, is that when you then went to the John Arnott Hospital?
No, then I did education for 9 years, and then my husband died. Yeah. I stayed another year and it was time to move on. Then I went to FACS, it was DOCS, Department of Community Services, and it was partnerships and planning, so funding Aboriginal organisations.
Oh, yeah.
So again, another positive aspect, funding the brighter future, stronger families, the, family support workers, our out-of-home care support workers. They funded preschools, or what we call preschool, Minda River Preschool, it was exciting. And I was there 9 years, and then I went to PNG for 5 days, and I saw absolute poverty, and I felt very embarrassed about my very comfortable lifestyle. So I had to leave, and I lived by faith for 12 months, And then I was contacted. I did 6 months work, Hunter Aboriginal Children's Service, 6 months Samaritans, and then I put in for the position at John Hunter. And I was there 9 years. And, yeah, at the moment I'm just, you know, on switchboard.
Yeah.
And the front counter, which is so demanding, yeah. You know, switchboard, but another set of skills, administration. And, look, anyone that works on switchboard, you're doing 500 calls a shift.
Yeah.
And you just come home, you don't want to hear the phone ring.
I have to applaud you for the being the Aboriginal liaison officer at the John Hunter Hospital. Couldn't have been an easy task.
I loved meeting our mob from all around the state. Mm. I love meeting the families, you know, and they're coming into hospital stressed. And so, you know, to have that curry face and understanding. And this job, you know, before I would go to any number of funerals, because we've always got funerals, but when I got to the hospital, I couldn't leave because this is about life and death.
Mm.
And so the only funerals I went to was, you know, very close elders that I'd worked with. So this again was a beautiful time. I enjoyed it. Love working. You know, I believe every day I get up, I work for my mob, for my people. Mm. It's not just to feather my own cap, but, you know, that's what I learned from Papua New Guinea.
Yeah. So as a, for Reconciliation Week, and you mentioned there a little earlier, but I suppose the most common name we hear is the Stolen Generation. And as you said, when you were five and your mother received a letter. So out of your experience, you've actually written a book about your story. And I was wondering if you could just read that part where you called the joyride, where when you was five, and I suppose with the bit that I did read, I didn't know that what you just said, that your mother just received a letter for you just to show up at the train. So did she know what was going to happen?
You know, we often think about it now. When we were children were never allowed to come near the adults talking. They'd shoo us away. Yeah, we'd have to hide behind a tin shack. We're trying to listen what they're talking about. You know what? I reckon they were talking about this. They're talking about the government coming, taking kids away at another camp, you know, or this camp. Because the men used to go away, hunting, gathering, building fences, rabbit trapping.
Yeah.
And they'd come home. Maybe it was once a fortnight, once a month, and then they would have a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
So we weren't allowed to listen to anything. So I reckon that's what it was. So she knew that this was happening. But isn't it interesting? They came when the men were away working. And so with the policeman standing there with a gun, of course you have to surrender your kids.
Mm.
And that's why our men took a big fall. You know, their grief and loss, because they're the provider, the protector. Yeah. And then all the kids are gone when they come back to camp, and they're feeling so guilty and ashamed because they weren't allowed to defend their family.
Mm.
So that's why, you know, when we were in uni, we're saying, it's all women here, where are the men?
Yeah.
But their grief was greater.
Yeah.
So they had to deal with all of that sorry business.
Yeah. Yeah, so if you could for us, yeah, if you could just read the first couple of pages.
Okay, thank you. Joyride. The first train ride I took is as clear in my mind as if it would have happened yesterday. Mum had all us kids dressed up, our hair brushed, which was only done for special days, and we were constantly reminded to use our manners. Barry, Widdy, Robbie, Sooty and myself were put in the back seat of a taxi while Mum sat in the front with the taxi driver. The lady taxi driver had known all the kids at the camp since their birth, and I thought it was strange that she and Mum didn't speak as we made our way along the bumpy red track leading from camp toward town. As I watched the red dust swirling from behind the vehicle, I remembered we were all dressed up and on our way to the station for my first ride on the big steam train. We'd always heard the faint train whistle from camp, and a few times we saw the clouds of smoke from the train, but I had never seen one close up. I sat impatiently in the back seat, clicking my shiny new black shoes together and admiring the new dress I'd been given for the day. All my brothers also wore their new shoes with white socks, a white shirt, and a little black bow tie. We knew everyone had to get dressed up to go on the train, and we felt important, like the little rich kids from town who often had train rides during the holidays. When we arrived at the station, we were surprised to see so many other kids and mum waiting on the platform. All the children were happy and running in between the legs of their mothers, playing tips to fill in time. It wouldn't be long before the huge, powerful black train pulled into the station. As we could see the dirty grey smoke pouring into the air half a mile away. It was a rare treat for us kids at camp to climb into one of our uncle's old cars and be driven into town. So when Mum said it was time to take our seat on the train, we climbed aboard jubilantly, anticipating the joyride. We took a few minutes to decide who would have the window seat or sit near the aisle. Then we kept changing places to decide who'd sit next to whom. Mum hadn't taken her seat yet, so we all took turns inspecting the toilet, which fascinated us. We knew it wouldn't be long before the train pulled out, so we took our seats again, but then we realised we'd lost Sooty and Robbie. When an old white woman in a red hat sat next to me, I changed seats with Barry as she terrified me. Suddenly I felt scared. "Where, Mum?" I asked Barry, who kept telling us, "Mum be getting on the train in a minute." I kept asking him, "Where were Sooty and Robbie and Mum?" And he said, "They must be in the next car." There were still lots of black women standing on the platform hugging one another. With a sudden jerk, squealing of brakes and a loud puff of the steam engine, the train shunted forward. Fear gripped my heart. Barry and Whitty had bewildered looks on their faces, glancing at me and then at each other. I stared out of the window as we slowly pulled out of the station. I was very confused by all the women standing on the platform watching us and wailing. Then I saw her. There was my mum in her only good blue dress standing next to my aunts and our old grandmother, just standing there with tears rolling down their cheeks too fast to wipe away. Then Mum waved a white hanky and I pressed my face against the window pane as hard as I could, watching until her blue dress faded into a tiny dot of colour. I looked back at the station for as long as I could, until it was out of sight. The atmosphere of celebration and anticipation that had filled the cabin vanished, and there now echoed the distressed calls of frightened, broken-hearted children. "Why didn't Mum and Grandma get on the train?" I cried over and over. The white woman in the red hat sat beside me with clasped hands, expressionless. Barry reassured me, "Mum will catch the next train. I'll look after you." But he was crying too. I didn't understand what had happened, why Mum had changed her mind, or why she would let us go anywhere without our auntie or grandmother to look after us.
Firstly, thank you. Thank you for reading that. That is just, I mean, for a lot of people out there who have never heard of the Stolen Generation or don't even think it's real, I mean, to be sitting, I mean, you're probably one of the first people I remember hearing your story many years ago, and being old enough to actually understand. Because I used to hear things about it when I was younger, but Mum and Dad would just say, "Oh, they would just say something real quickly and then just leave it at that. And then they'd tell us, don't ask any more questions about that person." Yeah, so I suppose what, as I said, with it being reconciliation and you going through that traumatic experience, before I get into it, I suppose I'd like to ask you, how have you handled that? Like, you know, like is there somewhere in life where, you know, it just become like when you get old enough and, you, and it becomes a reality of what happened to you and you really fully understand, how do you compute that in the brain? Because, I mean, for me, the simplest things in life sometimes I struggle with. But to have something like that, and like, and I also think, you know, I've got a little 5-year-old girl at the moment.
Yep. Well, as a 5-year-old, you don't know what's happened. As a 5-year-old, you're just told, you know, this is your new mummy and daddy, go with them. You go with them. I kept waiting for my brothers and siblings to come. They never came. We lived at White Bridge, and right in front of the house was a train track. And how many times I thought, if I just follow that train track, that'll take me back to the camp, not knowing how far it was. Going to school. When I was 12, 13, I was in denial. It was hard to say it was Aboriginal, because back in the 60s, they didn't have the knowledge. Teachers weren't teaching any Aboriginal studies. And so I just lived in this vacuum. When I was 16, 17, working, I soon learned that if I lied, it was easier, because you just want to be accepted. People say, oh, excuse me, do you mind if I ask you a question? You think, oh, no, what's coming? Are you Aboriginal? You know, what nationality are you?
Yeah.
So I'd learned that if I said I was Aboriginal, that wasn't a good thing. They would look down upon you. But if I said I was Maori or Fijian, that was acceptable. So I used to lie just to get accepted at work.
Yeah.
Got married, had children. Every time I gave birth, I thought, where's my birth mother? Does she know where I am?
Mm.
Then it wasn't till I went to uni and I hear my first or maybe about the third lecture there and, you know, Deirdre Heitmeyer's talking about stolen generation. And I'm thinking, that sounds like my story. I thought that just only happened to me. So that was a realisation. And I told my adoptive mum, and she couldn't believe it, because they just wanted to adopt a child because they couldn't have any children. Yeah. And they just wanted to say thank you to Australia for taking them in after the war. They were German, Yugoslav. So, you know, learning about what had happened to me at uni. And that's why I loved Aboriginal studies, because I was starting to put the jigsaw pieces.
So your adopted parents had no idea.
No.
They just thought they were just adopting and helping
out. They just wanted a little Aboriginal child, because they knew, they saw a lady with two little Koori kids and Dad said, go and ask where you buy these children. And Mum was so embarrassed, but when Dad spoke, you jumped. Yeah. And she went, she said, oh, I'm sorry, you know, because you see she's a white lady with these beautiful little kids. She said, look, here, you just write to the Australian, the New South Wales Welfare Association in Sydney, and they'll give you a child. They've got thousands of them.
Yeah.
It was just like that.
That's how it was.
Mm. Yeah.
As I said, reconciliation. I looked up the word. To make good again or to repair. Reconciliation is meant to repair relationships that are broken. Is that door open? Is the door open for you in reconciliation? Is there a Donna man that's just going, you know what, I've just got too much anger or hatred in me and frustration, what happened and what they did, that don't even talk about reconciliation to me?
So the Donna everybody sees isn't the Donna I was. I had to come to terms with my anger, and I remember being about 33, and I just woke up one day and I'm just sick of being angry. I remember when I met Archie Roach and Ruby, they came to Newcastle, and she said to me, you know what, we just woke up one day and Archie said, I'm sick of drinking, because he's trying to hide that pain of being taken away. I thought, yep, I get it. And so I had to make a decision, stop being angry, because you don't know what you're angry at. It's invisible.
Yeah.
You're angry at a system. You're angry at, you know, I didn't know it was politics at the time, but, you know, the system, oppression. You know, I was living in isolation. I didn't know one black fella. Uncle Bill Smith was the first black fella I saw on television. and he'd set up the Wabikal Co-op. You know, actually, it was the second. The first one was Jimmy Little when he sang his song in 63. But yeah, just living in isolation. And then fast forward, my story's so different, Rod, because I had these beautiful adoptive parents who were experiencing racism, being German.
Yeah.
The names that Mum and Dad got called.
Mm-hmm.
They were professionals in their own country, but coming to this country, then, you know, Mum's cleaning toilets at Thredbo for 3 months and Dad's a gardener. So having those special parents, and then my husband marrying a non-Aboriginal man. I hadn't met any black fellas, so it never entered my mind. And when I went to uni, you know, I'm getting judged, oh, you married a white fella, and half of them had two. Yeah. But, you know, when Uncle Bob Randall came to my place, I said, Unc, did I do the wrong thing into marrying? And he said, daughter, you call me daughter. He said, love doesn't have a colour.
Yeah.
So, you know, reconciliation, it's not just a theory or a policy. Reconciliation is spiritual.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was in schools, we taught the kids about, you know, reconciliation. We teach the kids reconciliation is about living and working together in peace and harmony. And who doesn't want that as an adult?
Mm.
So, you know, I talk about practical reconciliation. Like I said, all of those factors in my life has made me who I am. If I'd married the wrong man and he flogged me and he drank and all that, I wouldn't be who I am. Being raised in the church and, you know, growing up on those beautiful hymns. My parents were beautiful Christians, so I grew up with the hymns being sung in my home every day. So that has shaped me. Going to various churches and having interacted with kind white people.
Mm.
You know, that doesn't happen to my brothers and sisters.
Mm.
So everything has been so unique for me. And I know God has blessed me in my life and, you know, he's using me as a spokesperson. I see my mission to educate the church about Aboriginal Australia.
Yeah, that's good.
To promote what our people are doing locally.
Yeah.
You know, and I was doing that before we got the Courier Mail. It was great. We finally got an Aboriginal newspaper. But before that, you know, I was sharing with the churches. And I would take the coordinators from a Wabikal to these reconciliation circles. And, you know, dear old Uncle Dave Neen would speak.
Oh, yeah.
And then we had different workers, you know, and then they all became separate organisations. But
so spirituality for you has been a strong point, strong healing. And that's, was that one of the main things? And also, as you said, having that circle of good people around you.
Yep, makes all the difference. And so I love, you know, the Word of God and being obedient to it. I taught Sunday school scripture and then youth group and then, you know, just going through. And the churches have been welcoming to me. And it has brought healing and peace and comfort. So I, you know, when I went to uni and the students would say, you know, how can you be a Christian when the churches did this to us? And yes, I can now say to the churches, you know, you wonder why Aboriginal people aren't at your church, but yeah, the church is part of that assimilation policy.
Yeah.
The church endorsed it. The church helped remove the children.
Yeah.
So I understand their brokenness.
Yeah.
And so it's that to dance with creative tension, to both be willing to come together and to sit. When we sit down and share story and break bread, have a cuppa together, when we look each other in the eye, that's when we're looking at humanity.
Yes, yeah.
And that's when there's a change. When I'm doing cultural awareness, I aim for the heart. Change the heart before you can change the head.
That's good.
So it's a, you know, it's between survival and success. I guess success is what did it cost. But, you know, I choose to keep moving forward And yep, I've heard all the most negative comments. Could write a book about that, but to overcome that. And usually I find that anger, racism, it's really based in fear. What are you scared about?
Yeah.
You know, but when I look at the Human Rights Convention, economic and cultural rights, you know, I talk about diversity and equity.
Mm.
We've got rights. I had a minister say to me once, 1990, and I can tell you which church, and he said, why don't Aborigines step off the footpath anymore and let us pass? And I nearly died. I thought, I didn't hear right. I said, pardon? And he said it again. And I had Sandra Biles with me, drug and alcohol counselor.
Yeah.
And she said, should they have to? And then there was a discussion amongst the people. You know, we share the footpath. Who gets there first? And, you know, we step off the side. And it just showed me where his mindset was.
Yeah.
That keeps driving me. Even though I went home and cried my heart out.
Mm.
And I said, Lord, but he's a pastor. And the Lord said, but he's not listening to me either.
Yeah, it's good, yeah. But I like what you said, that there are lots of different circles out there and churches being one of them, but you're also being an ambassador for Aboriginal rights and Aboriginal education, I should probably say, in the past, and making them know that, because a lot of non-Aboriginal people say, but that was in the past, it's not our fault, but it's like, but the past that was set up is still the rules, the regulations, a lot of those are still in place.
That's right.
And it still benefits them.
Yes.
And that's why Aboriginal people today, still a lot of us, you know, we still get angry and frustrated at the system.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I loved how you read the Joyride. It was, just hearing you, and I was picturing back, you read there. It like as if you was 5 years
back
old,
there. Back
which
there.
Made it even more emotional. Have you, so did you ever meet your mother again, for those who have never heard your story?
So,
your real mother, I should say?
I found your birth mum, yep. And we wrote for 3 years, sparingly, because what do you really write about? Because so much water's gone under
just
the bridge.
How did you get back in contact?
So I knew as a 15-year-old, a teacher came to me at high school. I went to Wickham Girls High, which is next door to where Wobby
called. Oh, did you really?
That's where I went. And this teacher came up to me, PE teacher, Mrs. Brown, and her husband was in the welfare sector. She said, Donna, when you're ready, when you're 15, just go into the welfare and they'll give you a train ticket and you can go back home. But I didn't want to. I thought, I believe they sent me away. That's what a 5-year-old thinks.
Yeah.
10-year-old, 15-year-old. I thought, they didn't come looking for me. I don't want to find them. And that's why I didn't go home. But all my other siblings went home when they were 15, back to Canamble. I was now 25, went to a ladies' meeting at Toronto, where I now live. And there's one Aboriginal woman in the room, and I went up to her. I was very shy, I was very nervous. And I eventually went up to her morning tea, and she said, what's your name? I said, Donna Meehan. And she said, where are you from? I said, Edgeworth. No, where are you really from? Edgeworth. Where you been born? I said, oh, Canamble. My husband is your cousin. She said, Donna, we've been looking for you everywhere. I didn't even say Welsh. She just said, your mother is my husband's auntie.
Oh, wow.
So that was Uncle Cyril Welsh. And he came around that night, gave me the address. I wrote... Mum came to Newcastle on my 27th birthday and started reconnecting. She was teaching me about black ways. I was teaching her about the church, and I met all my siblings. I was the last one to come home. But they all knew I was going to come home. They were all on the corner at the post office waiting for this Tirana to pull into town. They just knew I'd come home one day.
Mm.
And, you know, when I read autobiographies and stories when our people went back home and they were rejected a second time by their own mob, how heartbreaking.
Mm.
You can't heal from that, you know. And, yeah, we had a Wobbicall through Moya Farrell and the Aboriginal Support Group.
Oh, yes.
We did the first Reconciliation Circle up on the foreshore. We had a smoking ceremony. All the elders sat there. We had Jeff and Dora Newton, Nora Doolin, and all the elders, the Lawrences, the Russells. And it was an opportunity. And driving in, I thought, 10 people might come. 10 people, 15. And we had 120. And that was back in 1992 or 93. And there was an elderly lady sitting on the grass. And I went and got her, Rita. She was from Alice Springs Mob. I said, come and sit down here with our elders. And she sat there. And, you know, all the white people are going past, shaking hands, saying sorry. And then she said, oh, sis, I can't sit here anymore. She said, I've been drinking. I need to go back on the hill. She was just respectful.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was just beautiful. So, yeah. In Reconciliation Week, we had a service at the cathedral, and the beautiful man, Honourable Ron. This elderly man, Wilson. Yeah, Ron Wilson. He came, and he had just finished that tour around Australia with Aunty Laurel Williams and a heap of others doing the research for bringing them back home. And we had a big reconciliation service at the cathedral, about 95.
Is it true? I don't know if years ago you said you were walking down, so before you met your family, was you walking down Hunter Street or somewhere and a black fellow was coming towards you and you started talking to him and it was one of your brothers? Is that true?
Yeah, my brother Wayne lives in Newcastle.
And you didn't
Shane
know?
Shane and Wayne, the twins. We didn't know.
That's amazing, isn't it?
He was here in Newcastle.
So what, did you recognise each other? I mean, well, because you was only five. How old was you when that happened?
Well, I had photos then because I'd gone home, we're looking for family.
Yeah.
So I knew what he looked like. Incredible. And then Jane, they were twins. I went to Melbourne, but she got separated. So remember when I said the twins were 6 weeks old?
Yeah.
They weren't on the train, but I was too busy.
Yeah.
You know? When she went through her records, they were still sitting in Canamble Hospital. They were still there for 6 months. And my poor old mum's walking the streets of Canamble, shattered, emotionally shattered, drinking her head off because you've lost seven children. Of course you're going to drink. And they were still sitting in Canamble Hospital waiting to be fostered.
Wow. That's unbelievable.
That's why the government needed to say sorry.
Yeah. I suppose for a lot of, one of the questions I have is just hearing more and more of your story, and I said, like, trying to have that just with even with yourself. For people who are in your shoes, there's a lot, you know, I've heard the stories where a lot of people haven't been able to heal.
Mm-hmm.
If there's anyone that's listening to this that maybe have just found out, you know, maybe they're in the shoes the same shoes you've walked, what advice would you give them?
Contact us. Don't stay alone in your room drinking, you know, being isolated. Go to a local, you know, medical centre. Speak to Aboriginal people. Start connecting to us. There are groups, there's healing centres, the Healing Foundation. There are programs. Start writing down your story. You know, my story took 13 years to write, and it's just a healing process. I would write, memories got unlocked. I'd blocked out things from the camp. And as I'm writing, so start writing a story.
Mm.
Go and write a song about it. Do a rap song to it, you know. Our brothers in jail are doing paintings about Stolen Generation. They're writing songs. They're writing poetry. That's all healing.
Yeah.
So start expressing it.
Mm.
Read books. There are so many books. I'd already been writing probably about 28 chapters when Sally Morgan's book, My Place, came out.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, oh, that's it. I'll give up writing a book. That's it. That's my story. But then I just kept journaling. But each time I went home to Canamble, I'd learn something. I'd meet another cousin. You know, I'd get a deeper insight. So write your story.
Did you, with your faith you're talking about, once you discovered everything about your past, did you ever challenge your faith? Did you ever hit a real low?
Probably not. It's the place I ran to for comfort.
Yeah.
It's the place I went to. It was my hiding place. Again, having two beautiful parents model that, I found the old hymns. I would just lie in the bed and just sing hymn after hymn. And each hymn was like a sermon. And, you know, God knows what you need in your brokenness. Yeah, I've had spiritual experiences that I can't share with non-Aboriginal people because they probably wouldn't believe it, but our people would. Mm. So God has just proved himself time and time and time again to me. If anything, I've had to get assertive to know how to respond with diplomacy with our people, because they're seeing life with blinkers on through their pain and grief, you know, and how can we understand? Because my journey hasn't been their journey.
Yeah.
But you want to find a place of solitude, a place that's safe. You know, I had this supportive husband. He wasn't a Christian, but he just supported me in everything.
Mm. That's probably, yeah, you know? That's probably one of the biggest keys. Yeah. Donna, we're going to wrap up soon, but as I said, reconciliation. I just want to read something else that I discovered. By the beginning of the 20th century, the colonial authorities felt obliged, I like that, felt obliged, not felt they needed to protect the Indigenous people in order to ease, not stop, but ease the process of extinction. I think there's a lot of people out there don't realise that once they took over this country, that Aboriginal people were put on the extinction plan. That was their plan. And they did this, and then they set up, you know, the protection board that was to protect us. But under that protection board, it gave them the policies and the government the power to determine where Indigenous people could live, who they could marry, where they could walk. You know, that's just some of the things. You know, just, and that's the thing, as I've gotten older and I've learnt more about policies and the rules that the government's made, and as you can see, a lot of them, the effects. I mean, you know, a lot of people say, oh, Aboriginal people, a bunch of drunks and drugs. But as here, you know, and your story, you know, and it's like the mental effect that has been caused for generation after generation to our people. And that's why a lot of people don't understand why we have a lot of dollars thrown into Aboriginal health, because we are just, our people in the past have just been so torn. And we're the leftovers of it, you know, and we're trying to pick up and put ourselves together. With all that, how does, I know we had the sorry day. Is that what the government has to do? Can white Australia reconcile with Aboriginal people? Can the government make it right?
There's many, many steps, and a lot of people are responsible. There's many arenas in society, many circles. You know, you've got your political arena, and, you know, we've got our people advocating in there, such as, you know, Mick Dodson, Pat Dodson. They're my heroes. That's who I look at. So, you know, they're trying to influence the politics. We've got the healing circle, you know, where we've got rehabs and counsellors and you know, drug and alcohol workers. We've got the ministry, the churches, Aboriginal pastors, chaplains, youth chaplains, chaplains in jail, chaplains in schools. You know, we've got a role to play, the education system. But once we started getting Aboriginal teachers in the classroom and AEAs, things started to change for our kids, because they were advocating for us. And so the sporting field, we see the Aboriginal sportsmen, you know, calling, you know, racism. Look what they did to Goodsey. I was just disgusted.
I still haven't seen that, but yeah.
You know, they, you know, they're calling it for what it is. So us workers in government, half of your role is educating your co-workers. And so, you know, being available to that, they know that they can come and ask their cultural questions of me. So you can only do that when you've had significant healing. So we're all on a journey. And I love that quote by Martin Luther King, who says, "The greatest tragedy in the world isn't the brutality of the bad, but the silence of the good."
Mm.
So the good, we need to stand up, support each other. Ray Kelly and I cried to see 5,000 people march with us for Black Lives Matter. Ray said, "Can you believe all these nationalities came and stood with us?"
Mm.
We were just blown away.
Yeah.
But I knew I had to march because I'm in prison ministry. I had to go and stand for our brothers.
Yeah.
And that treatment is absolutely not okay. It's not okay. And so, you know, we do what we can. We take responsibility. And then, you know, back with our people, it's a journey. It's a journey. And, yeah, I just pray that you find someone you can confide in and go to. Can I just share a poem, Rod?
You can.
Yeah.
Before you do that, I just thought of reconciliation and or reconcile is about healing too. When Kevin Rudd did the apology, did that help?
Yes. For me, my brothers, we were there.
Yeah.
And my brothers had parked. We were stuck in a traffic jam in Canberra. And so we could hear him saying the apology on the radio, pulled up, they got seats, I went and parked the car and then found them. And I'm walking towards them and, you know, it's probably what, 50 feet away. And I just started wailing. I've never wailed in my life.
Mm.
And I was wailing and I couldn't stop it, Rod. And then I sat down next to my brothers and we just hugged each other. And I just believe that was my mum's spirit, you know. And he had to say it because that was a recommendation, Ronald Wilson. That was a recommendation from the Bringing Them Home report to say sorry to our grandparents, to our mothers and fathers for what you did. Of course, there's many more steps.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're still doing that. My friend Linnell DeTippo, she's a pastor, and her sister Doreen Arnie Lill, we do women's circles, and so we're sitting with women and, you know, talking about these issues, singing, praying over them. Mm. So we have a healing ministry. So many responsibilities, different people, teachers, you know, they've got to be doing it right in the classroom and, you know, everybody else. And, you know, some people say, how can we have reconciliation with white folks? We've got to reconcile with ourselves. And that's true too. So, you know, that's part
that's
of
true.
Community and the church. You know, we do our business. You keep doing yours. The worst thing is just to stick your head in the sand.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to go away. We have to keep, you know. When we used to be in school, we did culture talks. And I remember this little girl, Lucy, from East Maitland Primary School, class 4B. She did a picture and it was a gold heart. And then in the middle, she had Uluru and the Sydney Harbour Bridge. So she had the black fella standing at Sydney Harbour Bridge and the white fella at Uluru. And this was about, you know, sharing resources, sharing this land, Australia.
That's good.
We can all do that. That's reconciliation.
Before you do the poem, I would just like to say thank you. Thank you very, very much for coming on a Wobble Pod, like that, a Wobble Pod.
It's so good. I love the name.
Your story is educational. It's sad, but it's also inspirational too. And it's also inspirational in the sense of, as I said, I've known you for a long time, and I actually remember, when you first used to tell your story, and compared to how you tell it now, you've grown so much. I think you're amazing. I think you're amazing to achieve what you've done from what you've come from. And if you want to finish this off, that'd be great.
Thank you so much, Rod. That's great. So this is called The Past. It's from Ujuru of Noonuckle, from her book, My People. And, you know, our grandparents were given white names. They had their names taken off them. So white Australia knows her as Kath Walker, but she took back her tribal name in 88, the bicentenary. And one of my favourite poems, but it says the past. Let no one say the past is gone. The past is all around us and within. Haunted by tribal memories, I know this little now, this accidental present, is not the all of me, whose long making is so much of the past. Tonight, as I sit here in suburbia, in easy chair beside electric heater, warmed by the red glow, I fall into a dream. I'm away at a campfire in the bush, sitting on the ground with my own people. No walls about me, the stars over me, the tall surrounding trees that sway in the breeze, making their own music. Soft cries of the night coming to us, there where we are all one with all old nature's lives, known and unknown, in scenes where we belong, but have since forsaken. Deep chair and electric heater are but since yesterday, but a thousand campfires are in my blood. Let none tell me the past is dead, for now is so small a part of time, so small a part of all the race years that has moulded me. The past isn't even past.
Thank you, Donna. Wow. Thank you. You know what we forgot to do? What is that sitting down there?
That's all right.
Now, hold it up. Before we finish, as we said, she's an author. Hold it up, Donna. What's it called?
It is No Secret.
And that photo, look at that. When I first saw that photo of you as a little five-year-old. So that's the photo of you, your first day in Newcastle.
Yep. And wow. Only first photo. My mother didn't have any photos of her children before they put us on the train. So that's what I was wearing when we left Canamble when I arrived in Newcastle. And It Is No Secret was the first song my Aboriginal mum sang to me when she came to Newcastle.
What's that one?
And then we have a French edition. So my little book has gone all around the world. So that's a French edition. And then I sold 350 at the Sydney Olympics in 5 days. I was selling one to every 15 at Cathy Freeman's, and I thought, I'm not even a sports person. So then we got Reader's Digest. That was 25,000 print run in New Zealand. And it's on e-books now, and of course now we're doing pod stations. So
yeah.
It's also at the public library. Okay. And it's recommended text for Aboriginal Studies Year 11 and 12. And, I need to do some more writing.
Yes, you do. Thank you, Donna.
Thank you, Rod.